I've got a brand new internet server and I have been setting up simple monitoring and observability.
I thought you were going to say you're going to give me the key, but
what?
I've got a brand new combine harvester and I'll give you the key. I'm showing my age a little bit there. Sorry.
I knew what he meant.
Yes. Well, I could give you my key because in the last episode, I explained how I could synchronize my secrets in various places. So, you know, you could be a sync target for my secrets, but I'm not going to give them to you. You're thoroughly untrustworthy.
I don't think I can handle that kind of responsibility. Please don't.
So this is off the back of going to OggCamp. Hello, OggCampers. Where there were several talks about the Fediverse and the ActivityPub protocol, and it regenerated my enthusiasm for fully committing to this open web. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be creating a server and I'm going to be ActivityPubbing all of the things. But before I can do that, I need to actually set up a server I can be confident in that it's actually up and running and doing the right thing. So I thought I'd start out by doing a little bit of making sure I know that it's working.
So what you're saying is now that you've got a new project to do, you've got some yak shaving first.
Yes, or YAML shaving, as it turns out. The first tool that I wanted to play with is a little callback to episode 30, where Mark recommended Notify or ntfy.sh. And that is a simple HTTP-based PubSub notification service.
Yes, it is.
And the reason I like this idea is that it has apps for your phone and you can get the notifications directly to your phone. And it's an open source product. It's also attractive to me because I am allergic to email, particularly getting service notifications and alerts via email, which I never digest or do anything with until that disk that was a little bit dodgy actually has exploded and I've lost something important.
Before I set up Notify, I also had scripts that emailed me things, and it's not a useful way among the noise of all of the other emails I get to be notified of things which are important.
Indeed, this is exactly how I feel about this. So I'm not going to go over Notify in detail. You can go to ntfy.sh and learn more about it. But it's a single go binary. They have a hosted SaaS platform, or you can host it yourself. And I chose, like Mark did, to host it myself. But where my experiences from Mark's may differ is that the server that I want to monitor is on that there public internet. And also my target devices are iOS devices, not Android devices. And I have learned there are there's a little bit of nuance in doing those two things. So what I've done is I've created a Notify server that is a private instance on the web. And there is a couple of mechanisms that you can use in the configuration to basically say, I'm the admin. I'm the person that can create topics and receive these topics. Topics are the effectively like channels that your messages get sent to, mm-hmm. whilst also saying, the great unwashed have no access to this whatsoever. They would need to log in order to do something useful on this server. So thereby having this thing publicly out there on the internet, but I'm the only person that can interact with it.
I think I've done the same thing, but I don't know if I've done it as thoroughly as that. I've done it like the channels that I post to are authenticated, but I don't know that, like, I think I could still create public channels.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I've done exactly the same thing as you, but I do have it so that only I can access my messages.
Yeah. So I've set things up that anyone that might idle by my instance can't start creating their own topics and publishing to them. I suspected that because you were running your stuff on your own Docker infrastructure in your own home, that it wasn't like exposed to the internet and that it was just for your local infrastructure.
No, it is because I still want to be able to get notifications if I'm away from home.
Aha, right. Of course, of course. And I suppose that brings me to my second point about receiving, in air quotes, push notifications on iOS devices, which technically speaking, iOS devices don't support push notifications. And there is a facility within NTFY to allow the propagation of immediate notification down to iOS devices. And the way that you do that is that on your NTFY instance, you say that there is an upstream NTFY instance that will relay the push, and you have to use the official NTFY server because something something iOS and signing applications means that app you've installed from the App Store can only receive what the equivalent of push notifications are on iOS from that like signed chain. So I think what happens is I send a notification to my NTFY server and it prompts the upstream to actually like notify my iPhone, and it works a treat.
Speaking of iPhone notifications, I'd just like to confirm that something Martin said earlier on, that he's allergic to email. On Monday this week, when I left the office, Martin was busily deleting email, and I got a notification on my phone Monday at 11:44 at night from Martin saying inbox zero achieved and a muscly arm emoji. So that part of my Apple notifications worked perfectly fine. Thanks, Martin. And I'm happy that you have reached inbox zero. And I guess where you're talking about being public access, I guess, you know, this is the difference between like private notifications and email, because email is inherently public. If people know your email address, right, they can basically trigger notifications and trigger interruptions in your day.
Yes.
So yeah, it's very different from that.
And the way that NTFY works is it's a very simple protocol, and the topics, we'll call them channels for simplicity, the place that you send notifications, they are unencrypted, unauthenticated. If you know the topic name on a server, you can spam it and generate a bazillion notifications. So you have to sort of do some things to protect yourself from being spammed erroneously. Anyway, NTFY was a fantastic recommendation from Mark. I've been wanting to do something with it ever since he recommended it, and I'm delighted that I've set it up. And one of the reasons why I set it up is because I found this piece of software called Gatus, which I think maybe I'm supposed to pronounce Gatus, like status.
Oh.
Which you could think of like a status page tool, which among other things can send alerts and notifications via just about every chat or API you can think of. And not just chat, but like file issues on all of the proprietary and open Gitforges. So it sends notifications everywhere, including NTFY. So Gatus?
I think probably Gatus.
Yeah, it's G-A-T-U-S. We'll have links in the show notes. I love this. This is so good. You may be familiar with similar proprietary tools. There's things like, you know, Pingdom and Status Cake. And the way that those typically work is that you'd log in and then you have a UI where you create your various services that you want to monitor in a, you know, click this, click that, choose these options. Well, the reason I like Gatus so much is that there's a single YAML file where you define everything you want to monitor. And that includes deep integration with DNS resolution and various HTTP status codes and SSH and even things like GraphQL monitoring. And fantastically, it can even do content checking of the websites that you're looking at. So not just is this website responding on a particular port, but does this page have this content in it? And is this server responding in this amount of time? Maybe you have SLAs. I don't have SLAs because it's just my server for fun.
I expect there to be a cup of coffee on my desk when I get to the office.
But it can also do domain expiration checks and certificate expiration checks.
Oh, that's handy.
It is handy because a few weeks ago, we had an API fail for linuxmatters.sh, and our automated status page notification service was keen-eyed viewers in our Telegram channel who alerted us to the fact that our website wasn't responding anymore. Little bit embarrassing. So one of the many sites I'm now monitoring with Gatus is Linux Matters, including making sure that certificates are not about to time out anytime soon and the domain renewal is happening in a timely fashion. And because Gatus is configured via a single YAML file, this can be exposed to the public internet, and it is a static site that is what you would recognize as a status page. All of the things that you have defined are visible. It produces all of the uptime metrics and the response time graphs and all of the things that you'd expect, but there's no logging in or configuring it. It's just a view of your infrastructure status. It's absolutely fabulous. Like NTFY, it's a single go binary. And like NTFY, they also have a SaaS platform, or you can host it yourself. And obviously I chose to host it myself. One of the things I really love about it, because back in the day this was hard to do, it checks itself. So before it starts sending notifications that things are down, it actually has a number of checks it can perform to make sure that it's not suffering some kind of outage or service interruption, which would mean it's erroneously sending on, you know, additional messages to you, which I don't really need for my personal server. But back in the day when I used to run lots of stuff, I would have liked a trivial way to configure that.
Was it Nagios or Nagios? I don't know.
Yes, that's it.
Back in the day.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah, exactly. You've triggered a memory from over a decade ago where I used to get notifications all the time, and it was the Nagios box that was broken, and it was telling me that everything else was broken. And it's like, you're gaslighting me, Nagios. It's you.
Yes. And one of the features it does have that most of these monitoring tools have is that you can set your interval for checks, and then you can set a threshold for how many consecutive failures before it actually issues like a failure notice to you. So I think I'm doing most of my checks every 30 seconds, and I've got a 2 failure threshold, which seems about right for my stuff.
Nice. I think I might have to pick this up and use it for all my nonsense.
It's mega easy to set up. And it also, which is quite handy, you can hide the host names of the services that you're monitoring. So in my case, I'm actually monitoring like the address of my internet-facing fiber router, but it doesn't expose that to anyone that might casually find the site and look at it. So you can't identify what my IP address is and try and, you know, break into my home network. Please don't try and break into my home network. This episode is sponsored by Tailscale, but get your finger away from that skip button. I'm going to explain how I use the free Tailscale personal plan to host global LAN parties and why you, fellow Linux enthusiasts, should check it out. Tailscale effortlessly provides the benefits of WireGuard without the hassle of manually configuring it. My office in town is seamlessly connected to our home LAN using Tailscale subnet routing, which is just a tick box configuration. It made it simple to set up SyncThing for offsite backups without exposing them to the public internet. I instantly switch between work and home tailnets to connect to the resources I need, and I even share a tailnet with friends in other countries to create a LAN to play old games that only offer multiplay over local networks. Loads of the Late Night Linux family hosts are using Tailscale to make complex configurations easier than melting butter with a lightsaber. And you could too, because the Tailscale personal plan will always be free. To support the show and become a networking Jedi, try Tailscale for free today. You'll get up to 100 devices and 3 users for free with no credit card required at tailscale.com/linuxmatters. That's tailscale.com/linuxmatters.
I've been battling with Bash. And I know in a previous episode, I said, from this point onwards, I'm going to do everything in Python. Well, I lied. because what happened is, it's very easy to have like just two commands. There's just two commands. There's no point writing a whole bunch of Python. They're just two commands that I want to string together. And then, well, I need to put another couple of commands in there, and I should probably put some variables in here. And then I've got to put it in a loop. And then I need to read from a file. And then there's some extra constraints required by one of the applications that require me to make another script. And I get to that point where I've invested so much time into this shell script. I'm like, I'm going to get this working, and I am not going to switch to Python. And that was me this week.
And this, dear listener, is the story of technical debt.
Yes. All right. I'll rewrite it in Python. I will. I promise. I promise. I will. I promise. So the thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to record some terminal videos. Now, don't shout ASCII Cinema at me. You don't need to do that. I'm aware of that tool. What I wanted to do specifically was make some animated GIFs that I could embed in certain places, like, for example, in slides in a presentation. And I could use MP4 videos. That's also potentially an option. But these are not especially fast-moving. They're not hours long. So I thought a GIF would be probably the right thing to do. And I've tried a lot of tools for recording the terminal, things like ASCII Cinema and others. And I had a very specific set of requirements that I wanted. I wanted it to look like a terminal with all the window chrome as well, because where I'm embedding it, the use case for me this week is that I'm going to a conference and I want to have some terminal type output running on a screen now and then behind the exhibition space.
So like a rolling demo.
Yeah, like a rolling demo. Every so often a little terminal pops up and shows you some, here's what the output of the thing is. And then maybe a slide that details the features and maybe some subtitles that explain what's going on, because there won't be any volume. That's the other reason why it doesn't need to be an MP4, is because it'll be a GIF, because it'll be too noisy in the conference space. You know what it's like. So I don't want to have loads of music playing. I don't want to have the sound that nobody will be able to hear. I can add some subtitles if I want to. If it's not clear what's going on the screen, I can supplement it with subtitles. But that was the goal, to create some terminal output from the applications that we use at work that are, a lot of them are command line stuff like Sift and Gripe and Grant and so on. And I tried a lot of the tools, and one of them that I really like is called T-Rex. It's written in Rust. I guess it's T-Rex, because I think is the logo a dinosaur, maybe?
Oh, it's only just occurring to me.
Someone, yeah. I mentioned it the other day, and someone at work went, oh, that's cute. And I was like, is it? Well, surely it's just a terminal recorder. That's all it means. And then I saw the logo, and I was like, oh, yeah. Now, T-Rex is quite old. It's been around a few years. It doesn't get a lot of updates, but it works. It's written in Rust. It's open source. You literally run it, and then it spawns a process, and then anything you type in the terminal from that point onwards until you press Control D is recorded. And what you end up with is an encoded GIF, or optionally an MP4, which actually looks like the terminal that you had. So if you're running GNOME Terminal, you run T-Rex, you are then presented with a shell prompt, and then you type whatever it is you want to type, and the results appear in the terminal. And then you press Control D to exit T-Rex, and then it encodes it all to a GIF. And that's basically the process.
So is it actually doing a screen recording, or is it just recording what's in the terminal and then doing some magic afterwards to make it look like the window you were using?
It's actually recording the terminal window.
Right.
And so it requires X11 and not Wayland. There is an open bug to make it work with Wayland. So I'm using it with X on my ThinkPad, connected to the very large dual-up display.
Excellent.
And this is one of the reasons why I quite like the idea of that dual-up display, is because I can zoom the terminal in and make it nice and big so that the recording is of a nice-looking font. It's, you know, it's not like 80 by 25, which I then have to zoom in and it looks like garbage because I'm zooming in a terminal, right? I want to be able to record it at a high enough resolution, like a good couple of thousand pixels across, that kind of thing. However, T-Rex is a little bit quirky. And one of the things you can do is, if you just type T-Rex on its own, you get this process in your terminal. You just basically get, it clears the screen, and then anything you type, and then you press Control D and you get your video, right? The other option is you could just put a command on the end of the terminal. So you could do T-Rex and then name of command that you want to run, and it will launch your command, record the screen, and then you're done. The problem with that is you can't give it any arguments. You can just run a thing and you can't pass any arguments to it. It doesn't allow that. Unless you can, and I haven't figured it out, neither of the other people who've filed issues.
It doesn't do it. I'm confident it doesn't do it.
So I had to do some shenanigans. And the shenanigans I did was I created a shell script which contains the command that I want to record. And so I run trec and then the shell script. And the shell script is basically one line of sift Ubuntu latest. And so trec then launches, starts recording, runs my shell script, which is just one line, sift Ubuntu latest, sift runs. When it finishes, the recording ends and I get a GIF. That's it. So that's okay. But two things I wanted more. One, I wanted to be able to record lots of these things because I've got lots of different command lines and I want to record lots of different GIFs doing lots of different things because there are lots of command line options. And I didn't want to have to sit there and keep replacing this shell script over and over again with the command and then re-record it till I get it right. The other requirement that I wanted, among many of these requirements, was I wanted to change the prompt. Because I'm logged into the terminal as me, I didn't actually want my name recorded in the recording. I wanted to have something else. I wanted to put the company name in there. So it kind of has the branding on there with Powerline. So it looks a pretty terminal. So I embellished my shell script a little bit. It still runs sift, but now it also echoes a prompt. And the echo of the prompt has the company name in it and not my name in it. It then also, I wanted it to look like someone was typing the command. Because it doesn't actually echo the command out. It just runs it, right? So I then have it echo the command, but I pipe that through PV. Today I learned you can do PV, which will slow down the bytes appearing. So it looks like someone's typing the command. And then I run the command and I capture the output. So what I end up with is a video which contains a nice prompt that's not got my name in it. Looks like someone types a command. And then the command runs and I get a GIF at the end. That worked.
And keen listeners will be spotting the scope creep, which is the technical debt that I referred to earlier.
Yes. So that worked. And then what I thought is, well, I've got these 10 commands I want to run. So I'll just put this thing in a loop and I'll put all the commands in one file and I'll read them in one by one. Oh my gosh. So I'm not going to go in depth at this. It was a nightmare. And I actually had Martin sat at my desk. The two of us sat there for like 2 hours this morning over coffee, trying to figure this thing out. It now works. I'm not going to go into, if you want to buy me a pint at some point, I'll bore you silly how frustrating this is.
If you want to be bought a pint.
If someone wants to get bored in a pub someday by me relaying all the frustrations with this thing, maybe I'll turn it into a blog post or something. I don't know. Anyway, it now works. And so I can provide it a list of commands that I want it to run, and it will just sit there and crank out these little videos. They only run at 4 frames a second. They're not like full HD and all that kind of stuff, but it's good enough that you can leave it running and it looks like someone typing and then a command running and you can catch the output. But one of the key things I really like is piping the output through PV means you can slow it down. And so when a command runs and produces many, many lines of output, rather than just go brr and fly by, you can do pipe the output through PV minus Q capital L, and the Q means quiet, and the capital L means limit the number of bytes that are going to be echoed over time. And so you can set that to a low number. So if I set that to 20, that's the typing speed. Like PVQL20 is the typing speed. But if I set it to like 100, that's kind of the output. And the reason I did that is because this is going to be on a TV screen and people are going to be walking past and just glancing at it, I want them to be able to read the odd word and it not just fly past and they can't understand what's going on, right? That was the goal. And it works.
One thing I really liked, because you were posting some of these on Mastodon as you did them, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Was you did one where I think you'd full screened it on your dual up. So it was a big portrait terminal window and I was looking at it on my phone.
Right.
So it was also the right aspect ratio for my phone.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I've recorded some that are landscape and some that are portrait, because I was thinking if I wanted to do like a short video, like YouTube shorts, because some of these are very short, they only take a minute to run and they do something quite complex, and you kind of might want to put some subtitles on there and explain what it does and say, here's how you do this thing, like search for vulnerabilities in your container or whatever it might be. And so I wanted to be able to do landscape and portrait, and my script can do it, because all you do is just open a terminal, make it whatever size you want it, and then run the script, and it will record the window at that size and at that aspect ratio. So I'm quite pleased with it, and I'm going to tidy it up a little bit, and I'll chuck it on GitHub or something. It's basically just a wrapper around T-Rec. That's all it is. And if you were at All Things Open and you came and said hi to me, I realize I'm talking about the future, like the past in the future. If you came and said hello and you looked at the screen and you saw the terminals, you now know how those were made.
This episode is sponsored by 1Password. Imagine your company security like the quad of a college campus. There are nice brick paths between the buildings. Those are the company-owned devices, IT-approved apps, and managed employee identities. And then there are the paths people actually use, the shortcuts worn through the grass that are the straightest line from point A to B. Those are unmanaged devices, shadow IT apps, and non-employee identities like contractors. Most security tools only work on those happy brick paths, but a lot of security problems take place on the shortcuts. 1Password Extended Access Management is the first security solution that brings all these unmanaged devices, apps, and identities under your control. It ensures that every user credential is strong and protected, every device is known and healthy, and every app is visible. 1Password Extended Access Management solves the problems traditional IAM and MDM can't touch. It's security for the way we work today, and it's now generally available to companies with Okta and Microsoft Entra, and in beta for Google Workplace customers. So support the show and check it out at 1Password.com/LinuxMatters. That's 1Password.com/LinuxMatters.
Linux Matters is part of the Late Night Linux family. If you enjoy the show, please consider supporting us and the rest of the Late Night Linux team using the PayPal or Patreon links at linuxmatters.sh/support. For $5 a month on Patreon, you can enjoy an ad-free feed of our show, or for $10, get access to all the Late Night Linux shows ad-free. You can get in touch with us via email, show@linuxmatters.sh, or chat with other listeners in our Telegram group. All the details are at linuxmatters.sh/contact.
One of the first things I did when I got to OgCamp was peruse the swaps table, which is a new thing at OgCamp this year, where people could bring along their spare bits of kit and gadgetry and leave it for someone else to take if they had a use for it. And one of the things I spotted when I got there was a little kit called the Kibo Mini.
What's a Kibo Mini?
And did you have to phone in advance on 01811 8055?
Is this an old people joke?
Yes, it's an old people joke.
This is right up there with the Combine Harvester lyrics.
So a Kibo Mini is a kit for building your own macro pad.
Oh,
yes. So it's made by Pimeroni. And what you get in the box is a couple of PCBs, some key switches and keycaps, and some screws. And you clip all of this together. It doesn't need any soldering. And then you plug it into the top of a Raspberry Pi Zero.
How many keys?
The Kibo Mini has 3 keys.
Right.
I'm a very smart and modern guy who knows exactly what a macro pad is, but some of our listeners might be from the past, you know, Combine Harvesters and all that, and might want to know the toot-sized description of what a macro pad is.
So a macro pad is sort of like an external add-on keyboard that you can program each key to do one or more things when you press it.
So like an Elgato Stream Deck being the proprietary version. Right.
Okay. Yes. So that sort of thing, except this one you put together yourself.
Nice.
You had my curiosity. Now you have my attention.
And you'll have my wallet very soon.
So, yeah, I followed the assembly guide. I found it on their website. Very easy. As I say, you just click and screw things together. Then you copy their software to an SD card. They have a Kibo OS distribution, which is a stripped down version of Raspbian, essentially. Pop that on a micro SD card, stick it in the Pi, and plug it in via USB to your computer, and it boots, and some lights flash, and it can then at that point type the numbers 0, 2, and 4.
Wonderful.
How do you configure it? Like, if you wanted to push a button and launch the Firefox browser, what's involved in doing that?
You have to remap the 0 key on your keyboard to Firefox.
Yes. So what it does is it is a keyboard and it can send key codes or a sequence of key codes. So if you specifically wanted it to launch a particular application, you would have to set up a shortcut and then configure the key to send that shortcut. So the way that you do this is, on the SD card, there is a file, a Lua file. You'll be glad to hear.
Oh, I like Lua.
And in there, you have a function for each key, what happens when you press each key. So that can be just sending one key press, if you have a key press that you need a lot, I don't know. Or it has some snippets for Windows, Linux, and Mac, which contain like the common sort of multi-key shortcuts for doing various things. Or you can have it do a sequence of things.
Right. Wonderful.
Did you say this has a Raspberry Pi Zero inside it?
This does, yes.
That seems quite heavyweight. I remember making a breadboard device because my ThinkPad T450 didn't have media keys.
Yeah.
And I bought a teensy like keyboard, and it was like Arduino microcontroller type thing. And I programmed 3 like tactile switches on a piece of breadboard as next track, previous track, play pause. And I guess you could use this for that kind of thing.
Yes, it's interesting you say that, because I was thinking this myself, and they don't make this Kibo mini kit anymore. What they do make is a new Kibo kit, which is based on the Pi 2040 microcontroller chip.
Right.
Right, that makes more sense.
Yes, which makes a lot more sense. So the current Kibo kit has, I think, 12 keys.
So you said that the one that you have has 3 keys on it.
Yes.
When I got my first, what are they called? Stream Deck. It's such a name collision. When I got my first Stream Deck, I got this, I think it might be called the Stream Deck Mini, which has 6 buttons on it, and immediately outgrew it.
Yeah.
So what button options does the Kibo come in?
The Mini has 3 keys, or you can get the 12 key one. I have configured these 3 keys for, one is media play pause.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is lock screen,
mm-hmm.
which I do a lot.
Well, that's a good idea.
And the other one is the terminal Quake pull-down shortcut thing that I have, because I always have that on set up on GNOME. So one will summon or dismiss my terminal, one will lock my screen, and one will play and pause media. I haven't yet found what I want a 4th key for, but I don't imagine it'll take me too long.
Mm.
When I do that, there's actually 2 options. There's the Kibo 2040 from Pi Moroni. Also, Adafruit do a macro pad kit, which also has a little screen and a knob that you can use as well.
A rotary encoder, I think you'll find they're called.
Thank you. A rotary encoder, yes. The thing about both these is, because they're microcontrollers, they're a bit more involved to do the programming, especially the Adafruit one. With the, as I say, this is just a Lua file where you have a function for each key.
When you say it's more involved, like, even an idiot like I could program a teensy, because they mostly come with the code and it's just a few lines. And I don't think it's super hard to like reprogram it and send the code down the cable.
Yeah. I mean, it's like CircuitPython or Arduino code rather than a bit of Lua. So, it's a bit more, but there's plenty of examples for things like this as well. If you're looking for a specific way of doing it, then you can find a lot, especially like Adafruit have just they have pages which are, here's what someone did with this bit of kit. And then it has a page with the code and talking you through it.
As I look at my 32 button Stream Deck in front of me,
one of your 32 button Stream
Decks, one of my 32 button Stream Decks, I make a prediction that Mark, in the not too distant future, will find the reason for a 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th button, and we'll be hearing more about this, because my Stream Deck has very little like live streaming features on it. I use it daily for all sorts of interaction with applications to automate a whole bunch of stuff. It's great.
I walk past Martin's office to say, would you like a cup of coffee? And he's got headphones on and he can't hear me and he's facing away from me. And I kind of reach a hand into the office. I'll just give you a little backroom, you know, indication of what goes on in our daily lives. And or I knock on his window. I try not to alarm him, but I almost always alarm him.
I always leap out of my seat.
He does. He leaps out of his seat because he's busy concentrating and I just want to get a cup of coffee. And he holds one finger in the air so that I don't say anything because he can't hear me. And then uses that finger, which goes down to the Stream Deck and presses the pause button and then pops the earbuds out and says, sorry, what? Every day.
Multiple times a day.
Yes. So, yeah, I think this is fantastic. I'm keen to hear if any of our listeners have got these kind of devices and what they use them for. We know Martin, like, uses them for everything. But I'm keen to know what you might get some ideas from the listeners as to what a fourth button might do.
Yeah, keen to hear. And I'm definitely going to take a look. I can see getting one of these. It would enhance the number of buttons that I can push when I'm alarmed by Alan knocking on my window.
Maybe you could mount one on the door, so when I walk past, I can press a button.
You could do a bing bong.
And it'll like come straight through to your headphones. That would be great.
Oh, this is a thing that's going to happen. Stay tuned, listeners.